Dialectical Behavior Therapy was created in the 1980s by Marsha Linehan in Seattle, Washington.
Today, DBT is taught all over the world.
We're two therapists who believe everyone can benefit from DBT skills.
I'm Kate.
I'm Michelle.
And this is DBT and Me.
Hello, everyone.
Hi, guys.
Welcome to Q&A 26.
Yes.
Which is almost certainly not our 100th episode, but we still need to figure out which one's going to be.
Might be the next one. The next Q&A.
You have to pay attention. Then we can, I don't know, blow little kazoos
or something exciting.
And
yeah, exactly.
Anyway. But so far, we're on Q&A 26, not yet our 100th episode. And yeah, Michelle's going to start us off today.
Yes. So the first post, I think it was a post of the Facebook group that I'm going to read, says, "Today my head seems to be filled with all sorts of emotions. Last month I applied for a subject access request to get answers to some of the questions I have from childhood. Today I realized that I should have a response this week sometime. I'm feeling rather apprehensive and anxious and have that heavy feeling in my chest. What if it doesn't give me answers? What if it makes me feel like a complete fool and makes me think I'm completely nuts? I'm trying to remain positive in the belief that whatever comes back, I can finally put it all to bed and carry on with my plans for the future. But today has been difficult."
It sounds like it was difficult. Just as a brief aside, Michelle, I just thought you'd laugh. Looking through, I don't know that I think I am playing the role of you. I did not talk about too many DBT skills in my responses to stuff for this Q&A, so... And now there's sirens. Please appreciate the beautiful wail that are the sirens of my neighborhood. Anywho, I wanted to start off by saying to this listener that I thought they were doing a really good job of allowing for space for multiple different emotions at once. And to an extent, you know, from that really good dialectical thinking. Right, this sort of, this is hard, it'll be better afterwards, right? This very much looking at everything that was going on for them, and I thought that was really admirable. So I wanted to point that out first and foremost. And the second thing I wanted to say is whatever answers you get, you're not crazy. Mm. It doesn't, I had to actually Google what a subject access request was.
Oh, you looked it up? Because, yeah, I didn't know what it was at all.
I had no idea. But looking at it, sort of like a records request, it seems like, from historical stuff. And I don't know exactly what that has to do with this listener's childhood, but I do know that stuff from childhood is hard. Like, especially if there's mysteries of any sort or unanswered questions around your own childhood. It makes sense to be really anxious about that, to be apprehensive and uncertain, because you quite literally don't know what you're going to find, and that stuff can hit hard. So I wanted to reassure this listener and anybody else who's dealing with trying to suss out answers from childhood stuff that, yeah, that's really, really difficult. So don't feel too crazy about that, because it makes sense to have that kind of response. And then the last thing I was thinking was just to tell this person to give themselves time to process. You know, not necessarily what they meant, but they talk about, you know, whatever comes back, I can just put it all to bed and carry on. And I just want to say that that may well be the case, but maybe on not a very fast timeline. So don't rush yourself through whatever it is that comes up. In response to whatever answers you get back, that's going to take some time. So try to be gentle with yourself and not necessarily be like, you know, read the stuff that you get back and be like, all right, cool, I know the answers now. Guess that's that. Mm-hmm. I don't know why I'm still feeling upset. It's been a day. Because I suspect it might take more than a day, especially depending on what you find out. So I just wanted to tell them to be nice to themselves, take it easy, and give themselves time to process.
Yeah. Yep. I completely agree with all of that. The thing that really stood out to me reading this was when the listener said that they have that heavy feeling in their chest. Mm-hmm. You know, for some people, they are very much in touch with the physical sensations in their body. It's maybe a really strong way that they experience emotions is by having their emotions come up as these strong physical sensations. But for other people, that's something that's really hard to access and get in touch with. And so just having this listener say that there was a heavy feeling in their chest shows me that the apprehensiveness and anxiousness, they were really in touch with that. Yeah. And as I've mentioned before on the podcast, with this practice of focusing that I do personally and that I've been trained in how to kind of guide people through, I mean, starting with a physical sensation is a great place to begin in terms of getting information about what you're feeling and in terms of self-soothing. Because when you can access a physical sensation, then what you can do, if you'd like, is just sit with it. Don't try to change it. Don't try to make it go away. Just sit with it and just kind of maybe see or ask, you know, what information can be shown to me from this heaviness in my chest. You may, like, if you close your eyes and really sit with it quietly like that, you may notice memories coming up for you. You may see just kind of mental images coming up for you or notice other emotions that arise. But just letting that heavy feeling be there rather than trying to shove it aside and keep going. I mean, there could be so much benefit to that. So I was just really impressed that that listener was able to access that and name it. You know, I think a big thing here is going to be a lot of radical acceptance around whatever those answers are. And radical acceptance, you know, Kate, I think you were kind of touching on this in your response, right? Of like, that idea of putting it all to bed, maybe it'll go that way, but maybe it won't. Radical acceptance is a process. And getting these answers may start this process of radical acceptance for you. If you find out some things that you really weren't expecting to find out from these results. Yeah, radical acceptance is going to be huge moving forward. And the other thing that actually kind of stood out to me, sometimes, right, we take these notes on Q&As, but then we actually read them out loud. And then I'll hear like Kate's responses and then new things come up for me that I didn't notice before. The other thing that I think feels important is when this listener says, what if it makes me feel like a complete fool and makes me think I'm completely nuts? Well, if you notice thoughts like that starting to come in, check the facts may be a good skill to go to also. Chances are you are not a complete fool and you're not completely nuts. So those may be kind of initial gut reaction sort of thoughts reading through, especially if, again, the information is information you were not expecting. However, I would guess that that's not grounded in fact. You know, those thoughts might not have a whole lot of basis in reality. Those might have more basis in emotion mind. So that may be something to turn to also is if you find yourself really reeling after these results, doing some check the facts might help as well if needed.
Makes sense. I like it.
Yeah.
All right. On to the second one. This one says, hey, guys, I've been struggling with mood disorders, self-defeating behaviors, and misery most of my life. I was advised to take a solo BPD treatment by my doctor. I don't know why I'm stumbling over my words today. I had a group one 5 years ago, and it was a disaster. Would you still recommend this method? I'm in a lot of pain these last few days and basically would try anything to feel better. Thank you in advance.
Yeah, so I'm pretty sure what this listener means when they say solo BPD treatment is basically doing individual DBT.
I hope so, because I realized in reading it out loud just now that I'd totally read it as DBT earlier, and my entire answer is also predicated on that. So, okay. Listener, if we fuck this up six ways to sideways, please let us know.
Yeah, we hope that's what you mean. Because DBT can be delivered individually or in a group format, right? Sometimes people do one or the other. Sometimes people do both, right? You have a group that you go to once a week, and you have an individual therapist that you meet with once a week. Side by side. So DBT can be delivered in a lot of different ways. Here's the thing though, no matter what, whether you're doing it one-on-one with a therapist or whether you're doing it in a group, the skills are the skills are the skills are the skills. Like, no matter what, you're still going to be learning and practicing the same skills. And every practitioner, every clinician is a little bit different because we're all, you know, our own individual selves in terms of how we teach DBT and how we format that. But just to share a little bit of how I do individual DBT with people, basically, yep, we start off session with checking in about their diary card or their homework for that week. We spend, you know, not too much time, 10-ish minutes on that, maybe 15. And then we move into talking about a skill for that week. I really only do a lot of teaching of the skill if someone has not already gone through a skills group. Mm. So if they're kind of learning the skills from scratch, I'll teach the skill and talk about it for like the next 15 to 20 minutes. Then we'll have them practice it in session or do a bit of a discussion around it for about another 15 or 20 minutes. And then we wrap up with kind of what their homework is going to be for that week. It's a lot crammed into a 50-minute therapy session. But that's kind of how I structure it. And that's not horrifically different from how Kate and I structure our groups. Groups start off with a homework check-in and then move into us teaching a skill. And then we have our group participants practice the skill in some way. So it's kind of the same idea, but here's the thing about some of the benefits of doing individual DBT. Basically, you get that one-on-one attention, especially because you've done a group, you're listening to the podcast, like you may already have a pretty good knowledge of like what these skills are. So you might not need a whole lot of teaching time in doing individual therapy. So what that means is that during that 50-minute therapy hour, rather than rehashing what is this skill, what is, you know, what does it stand for, what the acronym and that kind of a thing, you and your therapist can really dive in and talk about how are you using this skill or what gets in the way of you using this skill. What do you like about it? What do you find challenging about it? And the two of you can really problem solve if there's something about that skill that makes it hard for you. You know, one of the downsides of group, even though Kate and I really do our best with the groups that we teach to like answer everybody's questions as they come up, some nights we just don't have time. We just don't. So sometimes we have to, you know, we'll try to, if it's a night where people have a lot of questions, we'll have to kind of try to, you know, we'll tell people, okay, we're going to write down your question. We're going to answer it at the start of group next week, or we'll text with people or do a call with people if needed. It doesn't come to that very often. But the good news is that with this being your 50-minute therapy hour, you can ask the questions that you have. And again, just have it really individualized so that your therapist is understanding how these skills work or do not work for you, and you can get a little more insight. I also want to say I'm really sorry your group experience was a disaster.
Right?
That sucks. We always hope that people have a good experience in group, but every group is different. And different people are in different places with their mental health, and there can be a lot of factors that influence whether a group is cohesive or whether it's not. So I really hope that you'll have a better experience doing individual therapy, but my long and short answer to your question of like, would you still recommend this method? Absolutely, I would. I think there could be a lot of benefit from doing DBT individually. So that's what I say. What about you, Kate?
Well, honestly, I don't have a huge amount to add. That covers a lot of sort of the groundwork thoughts that I would want to get across. I guess the first thing that just stood out for me that wasn't, you know, and I get it, you know, a lot of these things are posts or other things that, you know, you don't want to just yak and yak in forever, but the listener didn't really talk about what was disastrous about the group. And so the question I had was, like, what about it was disastrous? What didn't you like? Because I think that's going to have a huge amount to do with the recommendation. Without knowing that, I would definitely still recommend solo DBT, because it's such an effective, you know, it's a wonderful treatment for BPD, literally designed for it. On the other hand, if the thing that made it disastrous was the DBT skills themselves.
Yeah.
As you said, the skills are the skills are the skills. Now, on the other hand, I suspect that's not it, because it'd be a little weird that someone was listening to the podcast and they just hated the skills themselves.
Yeah.
Right? But so, whatever it was that you didn't like, listener, I would kind of apply that and listen to what Michelle was just talking about how groups and individual work can differ and things like that, and think, okay, are the things that I didn't like sort of addressed just by switching from a group atmosphere to a solo atmosphere? Or, I don't know, depending on what you didn't like, would they be made worse by going from being one in a part of a group to being the only person, right? So, like, is that focused individual attention something that you didn't like? Right? Mm-hmm. So, I don't know. I, without knowing the what of what made it disastrous, my thought is damn near identical to yours, Michelle, about the recommendation, etc. But the only thing I would ask that person or anyone else who's pondering this kind of question to think about is, really, what didn't you like? Right? Not in a, like, well, what didn't you like kind of way, but just, you know, actual introspection, kind and gentle, like, okay, what made that hard for me or icky for me or terrible for me? And then see whether those elements are likely to be present or not in a solo thing, right? Was it just, I hated the person who led the group? In which case, I think you're golden, as long as you don't have to work with that person as an individual. Mm-hmm. You have a pretty decent chance of having a different human being be the person who's leading the group. So, yeah, just think about what you didn't like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good question to ask. Okay. The next one says, my first year of DBT, I don't even have a word for how dedicated I was to my diary card. I'm now a year and a half in, and I want absolutely nothing to do with them. How can I find some inspiration to fill them out again? My therapist has me do them in session when I don't do them, but even then, the motivation is not there.
That makes sense to me. Mm-hmm. But I know that it's funny, because in a different episode that we were recording, I was just talking about how routinized I can be, but also anything can become boring. Like, just anything can become boring. And so the first thing I wondered was, what motivated you in the first place? And can you try and tap into that again, right? I can think of so many different motivations for being super dedicated. Everything from, I was feeling passionate about tending to my own mental health, and so I was just driven to do whatever I needed to do to try and take care of that, all the way to, maybe it was as a part of a group environment, and I don't know about this listener, but I'm prone to trying to be, I don't know, the goody-two-shoes teacher's pet, best in the class kind of thing. So I might be very motivated to be like, I did my diary card, look, see, I did it, I'm good, I did the thing. That would be very motivating for me. Whereas it might not be, I might not have that same motivation if I were just working individually with someone, or, right, there's so many different things. And so, musingly, similarly to the last one, I mostly have questions around this one of, What motivated you before? Can you find that again? Another thing that I wonder is, if you're shooting on yourself about doing the diary card, oh, I should do my diary card tonight, I should do it more often, right, that sort of thing, I shouldn't put it off so long. Because if you're shooting all over yourself around it, It makes perfect sense that you don't have motivation. Should steals our motivation? We're actually considerably less likely to do anything that we're telling ourselves we should do. So that occurred to me as a potential reason why this person might be struggling to find that same motivation, is maybe they're shooting on themselves about doing it. And then the last thing, the sort of solid recommendation that I was thinking about, or not solid, potentially solid, is maybe change up what diary card you're using just to change things up a little bit. Michelle and I have certainly, for various and sundry reasons, spent time online looking at all sorts of different diary cards that exist. There are so many. And let me tell you, there are some that I just look at it and immediately I'm unmotivated. I've never even tried to fill that fucker out. I already don't want to because it just looks daunting. Right? So everything from that to, I will admit, Michelle and I's are probably on the simpler to simplest end of diary cards that I've seen for DBT. Which I, well, we, I guess, personally, obviously enjoy, but someone else might be like, what's even the point? This hardly gets any information out of me. Like, this hardly seems worth it to put even any effort or thought into. So maybe see if something about the literal diary card itself is part of what's interfering with your motivation or inspiration. Because I'll tell you what, there's a lot of options. You can definitely find another diary card that's different from the one you're using now. I don't know what you're using now, but there are other ones out there. And so, you know, assuming your therapist, etc., was on board with that, that might be a way you could change it up and find more inspiration. But just, yeah, just a lot of curiosity. I guess that's what I want to, that's what it comes down to, I guess, what I'm thinking of is, so often when we fall out of a habit or something that we really want to be doing or that we think we quote unquote should be doing, the first thing to crop up is self-judgment. Like, why am I not doing this? I used to be so good at this. I suck at this now, right? That kind of thing. Which is not helpful. That is not going to get you closer to doing the thing again. And so maybe just to shift a little bit in the attitude that you're bringing to it, to genuine curiosity, like, huh, I wonder what changed for me. I wonder why I don't find it as motivating before. Has something changed in my environment? Has something changed in me? Are you less motivated just because you don't need it as much anymore? Right? Maybe you've just gotten so integrated with your DBT skills that it seems weirdly pointless to have to fill out this damn piece of paper when you're utilizing them every day anyway. I don't know. But just this idea of curiosity and a lack of judgment. And I think you might be surprised by your ability to find out kind of your own answer to the question. So long as you're being kind and curious mm-hmm. towards yourself, which is, again, in no way DBT related, because I apparently didn't want to mention almost any DBT skills this time.
I'm not going to mention them either. No skills here. But I do want to reference the episode we made. I don't remember when. I don't know the date that we released it, but I did look up the title of it. The episode titled How to Use DBT Skills in Daily Life. I would recommend listening to that if you haven't already, because in that episode, we specifically talk about some of the challenges that come up with using skills. We talk about diary cards. We talk about lack of motivation to use skills. Now, I don't know what applies specifically to this listener here. I mean, my sense in reading this, it could be off base, doesn't sound like there's a struggle with the skills themselves. It's a struggle with the diary card specifically.
Yeah.
And we do talk about diary cards in that episode because sometimes people struggle to remember to fill them out or, yeah, to feel that motivation. But I don't know. I'm going to try to not get up on too much of a soapbox here, but I'm probably going to anyways. And my soapbox here is that you have been doing DBT for a year and a half. You are not new to being in a DBT program. You're not. Diary cards can be hugely important when people are just starting out. The reason why is because there's a lot of material that you're learning pretty quickly. You know, you're learning at least one skill a week. And the whole point of a diary card is to help you remember and recall the skills that you've learned and to kind of hold you accountable to make sure that you're implementing them in your life. And somebody who's new to a DBT program and is learning these skills for the first time, that's pretty needed. That's why the vast majority of DBT programs, not all, but the vast majority use a diary card. You, listener, are a year and a half in. So I kind of think of it this way. Sometimes I compare the realm of substance abuse with the realm of mental health because there are certain similarities there. Somebody who is fresh in sobriety, they might attend a 12-step meeting every single day or multiple times a day because that's what they need in early recovery to maintain their sobriety. You will be hard-pressed to find somebody who, say, has 20 years of sobriety under their belt and is still going to a meeting every single day. Perhaps. But that person at some point likely decreased how often they were going to meetings. Now, maybe they only go once a week. Maybe they only go once a month. They're more established in their recovery, and what they really needed in the beginning, they don't need as much now. They've probably found other things to rely on to help them maintain their sobriety. So the reason why I bring that up here is because I think, as I was saying, that diary cards are hugely important in the beginning of learning DBT. And also, you're not meant to fill out a diary card every day for the rest of your life. Sorry. That's just my take. Again, if some people really want that and feel like they need that and feel like they benefit from that, oh, by all means, then do it. If it's a really helpful tool for you that you want to keep up doing. But I think it also makes sense to decrease the use of a diary card over time, especially if you find yourself regularly using skills and remembering skills, and it feels like DBT is just kind of a part of how you're living your life. I don't know if you necessarily need a diary card any longer to, you know, hold you accountable in that way. And no shade on your therapist for making you do one when you don't do them. There are a lot of DBT therapists out there who, I don't know, I'm trying to think of how to explain it, but I feel like they can really rigidly cling to, like, the fidelity of DBT. So kind of this idea of, this is how DBT was designed, this is how it is meant to be.
The and letter, not the spirit.
What'd you say?
The letter, not the spirit.
The letter
of the law instead of the spirit of the law.
Oh, I get what you're saying. Yeah. And so it's kind of this idea of, like, when you're a therapist and you're getting trained in DBT, a lot of the, you know, messaging that you receive is about the importance of accountability, is about the importance of a diary card. And I don't like that this is what's portrayed a lot of times in teaching about DBT to therapists, but kind of having clients portrayed as, like, you know, recognizing problem behaviors and recognizing resistance and recognizing that people may, you know, try to skirt around what they're supposed to do with DBT and, like, not want to use the skills, and that our job as the DBT therapist is to hold them accountable and challenge those behaviors. Again, I don't get the sense that that's what's going on for this listener. I really don't. So I think it would be worth talking with your therapist about the diary card. If you haven't shared this with your therapist already, I mean, the therapist might be able to sense that you're struggling, right? Because you're having to fill them out in session and you're showing up with them not being completed. But I would have a frank discussion about what purpose can diary cards be serving for you now? Are you just doing them for the sake of doing them? Is your therapist just having you do them because they were told when they were trained in DBT to have you do them? Like, if we look at this really critically, what are you getting out of this? And I like Kate's idea of maybe changing to a different diary card. That may mix things up for you. But I wonder if, you know, this is really a tool that you need now. Mm-hmm. And you might not. And I would be fascinated to see how it goes for you to go a week or two without using a diary card. You've been using them for a year and a half. And lots of diary cards want to be filled out daily. So how would it feel to go a few days with no diary card? And just being open-minded to that, maybe you realize, oh, snap, I do need that. Or maybe you realize, oh, I do okay without it. And either experience is okay, but just to give you some information. So, yeah, I don't know. I kind of more or less support you in maybe not needing a diary card anymore is what I'm
Michelle
getting
Michelle the Rebel. This is not something. This is not a Michelle I'm as familiar with.
I have a love-hate relationship, I think, with diary cards. And I have a love-hate relationship with how rigidly I think DBT is taught to therapists who therefore then teach it to their clients. Mm-hmm. You know, it doesn't have to be, like you were saying, Kate, like by the letter all the time. It's okay to be a little more flexible, but there's not always that space. Yeah. Anyways, those are my thoughts.
I like them. All right, on to the last one, I think.
Yeah, last one.
This one's short, but packs a heck of a punch. It says, yeah. Hey, y'all. Looking to see what skills would be best for suddenly losing a romantic partner, as in the romantic partner died. It says, I'm really struggling, and I feel nothing I do will help. Thanks.
Yeah. Exactly as you put it, Kate. Short post, but that's a really challenging one. The first thing that came to mind for me, again, this has nothing to do with DBT, but is a book recommendation. And the title of the book is It's Okay That You're Not Okay. The author is Megan, I don't know if you say it Divine or Devine, but I would highly recommend reading that book. I recommend it if you've experienced any kind of loss of someone that you loved, but specifically for this listener, Megan, the author, lost her romantic partner suddenly. So, you know, of course, every situation is different and has its own intricacies and things like that, but that might especially bring this listener some comfort, is that the author also went through the same type of loss, you could say. Mm-hmm. The reason why I like the book is because it really is very dialectical throughout, in the sense that it talks about how this, you know, death is the most tragic, awful thing that doesn't really ever get better. And also, how can you be in that place while finding ways to take care of yourself? Like that kind of a thing. So if I really boil that down, it talks about how much this sucks and how it can suck less, essentially. And she balances that beautifully because she's been there. So great book to read. In terms of DBT stuff, a lot of this, which again, it is kind of recommended in the book too, but is really about being mindful of your emotions. You are going to have some days that feel better and some days that feel worse. And better doesn't mean good. I think Kate and I say that sometimes, right? But you may have some days where you're functioning at 5%, some days where you're functioning at like 15%. Okay, let's be curious about that. And again, kind of notice what might make one day different from the next. If you have a day where you are feeling a little bit better, really try to tune into that. of what might be factoring into that, whether it's something internal within yourself for what you're feeling or experiencing or thinking about, or if it's something external that happened that lifted your spirits ever so slightly. Just noticing. And mindfulness, I think it's really hard when you're in the midst of grief, especially like Megan talks about this idea of like deep grief, right? Mm-hmm. So deep grief is kind of when you are just reeling from the fact that this person is gone, and can last up to 2 years. So that's going to be really hard, because there's going to be some days where you're just going to feel like a zombie. And tuning into how you're feeling is going to be very difficult. But if you can get to that place of noticing and tuning in, that will serve you, I hope. The other thing is to really try as best as you can, while also being super kind to yourself, to practice please. Lower the bar a lot for what it's going to look like. But again, it might be, okay, I ate twice today. Yesterday, I didn't eat at all. Today, I got up and I went out to check the mail, whereas I haven't really moved from the couch in 3 days. Right? So what please looks like is going to look different when you're in grief, for sure. You know, it might be like, I only woke up 3 times in the night instead of 7. Those kinds of things. But if you can find little ways to really try to tend to your physical body, that will help you as you're in the grief. It's not going to make it go away. It's not going to make it stop, but the hope is that it will help you get through it with a little more ease if you're able to, as best you can, try to get sleep, try to eat, try to move your body. By all means, please be aware of and noticing if you're falling into using substances. Again, it's all so natural. No judgment there, because it's incredibly common. And also, it's something that could potentially lead you down a path that you might not really want to go down as you're trying to cope. And I wouldn't, you know, this is common, I think, with grief, that we feel it in our bodies, right? More headaches, more likely to get sick, more likely to experience physical pain. So tending to that in the way that you need to, just being really kind and going really slow with yourself is overall what I recommend. Yeah.
Yeah. I normally in notes, I'll put things like just saying empathize or something when the first thing I want to say is something empathetic. And I went to go type that in today and realized that I can't, that the best I can offer is sympathy, because I've never been through this kind of loss. But all of the sympathy, just all of it, because I cannot imagine that kind of sudden loss. That all said, just because this person was seeking specific skills, the temptation is to say almost the entirety of the, distress tolerance stuff, right? Because that is precisely, what that's for. But, you know, instead of just being like, cool, bye. The two that stand out the most for me, with possibly a third, because I'll admit, Michelle, I thought you might mention other ones, so I sort of left it open for you to mention other ones if you wanted to. Are radical acceptance. If you haven't already listened to our episodes on radical acceptance, or episode, I think, on radical acceptance, please do. It's not a one and done.
Yeah.
Right? I'm in no way suggesting that you're going to wake up tomorrow and radically accept that your partner just passed away suddenly and poof, that's fine now. It's going to be a thing you're going to have to do over and over and over and over and over and over and over again. It's going to be a process for a really long time. And it helps. Right? You can't, it's not going to make you stop hurting, but there's a different flavor to pain when you're still fighting what's real, as opposed to allowing yourself the pain of what's real. And my experience is that healing comes much more easily in the place where you're from a radical acceptance place. If you're still fighting reality, it's awfully hard to heal from the wound reality has caused. And so radical acceptance, I think, is so fucking hard and equally important. In situations like this, in many ways, the worse the thing, the more important radical acceptance becomes. And this is a real bad thing that this person is going through. And then second to that would be self-soothing. Michelle was talking really beautifully about how many different ways grief can show up, including in the body. And also, I don't know that you were necessarily mentioning this, Michelle, but I think that a couple of different things, like grief can show up in the body in all the ways you were talking about. And also for some other people, grief can really disconnect you from your body.
Yeah, definitely.
And self-soothing in its own way kind of addresses both of those, right? It can help to tend to your body in a way that might help soothe some of the literal physical suffering that you're going through because of the grief. It can also be kind of a gentle invitation back into your body. As a more, sometimes more accessible way to take care of yourself also, because grief can really fuck up our heads, right? And so more brain-oriented skills, or just even trying to think hard about much of anything, can be incredibly difficult, especially in that like initial super intense grief. But your body is still there, and you might be able to take care of yourself. Michelle talks a lot about bottom up, top down, right? You might be able to access bottom up self-care before you can, you know, access top down self-care. And so that's why I think of self-soothing as being the other go-to. Since Michelle didn't mention them, I will just put out there that, you know, accepts and improve can also help, because Lord knows people who are suffering as much as, you know, this listener sounds like they may be, like, give yourself some breaks if you can get at all distracted. If there's anything not explicitly unhealthy, says the woman with the history of self-harm, if there's anything on the healthy side of things that can distract you, allow yourself that. Right? You're not dishonoring your partner by being distracted for a while. Right? I think there can be this sense during grief that if we put down the grief for even a minute, that somehow we're a bad person.
It's like a betrayal, right? Of the yes, person who died. Yeah.
Exactly. And so I want to mention a distraction or distraction techniques, just because you're going to need breaks. You're going to need moments when you're not wholly in your grief and nothing but your grief. And that's okay. That's not a betrayal. That's not a dishonoring thing. That's you making sure there is someone to continue to hold on to that person's memory, right? If you don't take care of yourself, then what, right? Also, ideally, this person cared about you too before they died.
they'd want you to have those breaks. They wouldn't want you to just be miserable. So, I think those are the ones that come to my mind, a radical acceptance, self-soothing, and anything healthy that distracts you.
Yeah. Yep.
Like,
yeah. That's all great. The other thing I also thought of when you mentioned a radical acceptance episode is that we do also have the episode, I think we just titled it Grief and DBT.
Probably. Something like that.
Yeah. So even though, I mean, yeah, Kate acknowledged that she hasn't experienced the sudden loss of a romantic partner. I have not either experienced the loss of a current romantic partner. My ex-partner, who I was with for 8 years, did die suddenly in December, but I was not in a relationship with him at the time. So that is a very different experience than losing someone you're currently in a relationship with, like this listener did. So Kate and I both have not had this exact type of loss, but there may be something in that episode about grief and DBT that may be helpful for this listener too. So
yeah,
you can give that a listen also if you haven't already. Yeah.
Yep.
Okay. I think we're ready to wrap this one up.
Yeah. Probably.
So, if you guys have questions for us, you can either post them in the Facebook group if you're already a member there, or send them to us in an email, dbtandmepodcast@gmail.com, and we'll be back soon with another Q&A.
All right. Talk to you guys soon.
Thanks, guys.
To learn more about us and the DBT skills we're teaching each week, join our Facebook group. Simply log in to your Facebook profile and search for DBT and Me Podcast.